Next on Afterwards, military strategist Thomas Barnett lays out his new roadmap for U.S. foreign policy and national security. It's titled Blueprint for Action, A Future Worth Creating. He's interviewed by U.S. Congressman Tom Feeney of Florida, who serves on the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security.
We're delighted to be here today with Mr. Thomas Barnett. First, I want to thank C-SPAN and all of their viewers today. I think we've got a very exciting program by one of the most dynamic, important, and controversial writers about geopolitical and military strategy for America. Mr. Barnett, welcome. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me, sir.
Mr. Barnett, who you've heard a little bit about, among other things, is a Harvard PhD in political science. He's gotten attention of futurists, of the Pentagon, of the President of the United States, and the top officials that think about the future of American geopolitical strategy. As a matter of fact, Mr. Barnett recently met with four-star General John Avezate and his staff, who are in control of and operate the Central Command, which controls American operations in all of the Middle East, including Iraq. Mr. Barnett, you really caused a stir with your first book, which was called The Pentagon's New Map. And it got the attention of people throughout the military establishment and futurists and visionaries. Would you briefly, because we're going to talk about your second book, but would you briefly tell us the general thesis of The Pentagon's New Map?
It really sprung out of a PowerPoint briefing that I developed working as the Assistant for Strategic Futures in the Office of Force Transformation for an individual named Art Zabrowski, the Director of the Office of Force Transformation, in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And what Art Zabrowski was asked to do by Secretary Don Rumsfeld was really to come up with a vision for the future of the U.S. military in terms of the capabilities it would seek to bring to bear on conflicts. And what Art Zabrowski asked me to do, in effect, was to come up with a grand strategy by which his choices in terms of technology and in terms of new doctrine and procedures that he would seek to promote in this office would be guided. It was a rather impossible task and a very challenging one. I got the offer to do this almost within days of 9/11. And so it really felt like you were operating with a blank slate in history. Now, the basic concept of the map, which is the guiding principle of the entire strategy, is to say, let's look at where we've sent U.S. military forces since the end of the Cold War. Okay, so from 1990 roughly to today, it's almost 150 crisis response activities. Some of these operations quite short, some of them quite lengthy. And what we did is we plotted them geographically on a map and then drew a line around 95% of them and asked the question, what is it about these regions that seem to attract U.S. military interventions time and time again? And the underlying thesis which we put out there was basically, these are the regions least connected to the global economy. Okay, least connected in terms of physical connectivity, trade connectivity, movement of people, goods, services, fiber optic cable laid, Hollywood box office receipts, however you want to measure it. Connectivity thicker around these areas, thinner in these areas.
And the ultimate importance to American security is that, as you say, disconnectivity equals danger for Americans.
Disconnectedness defines danger. Where the global economy, in effect, has not yet penetrated in terms of deep connectivity, that's where the violence is in the system. And in fact, where globalization comes upon more traditional societies and tends to reformat those societies in a very challenging fashion, especially in terms of its rapid redefinition of the role of women in families, in society, in economics, even in politics, it engenders often a negative response, a response to keep it out. And that definition of the Middle East is currently defined by the global Salafi jihadist movement. So I call those regions of the world where we sent military power almost exclusively since the end of the Cold War the non-integrating gap. In a nutshell, it's a collection of regions. It's the Caribbean Rim, the Andean portion of South America, virtually all of Africa. In the 90s, it included the Balkans, less so now, but the Caucasus, Central Asia, Southwest Asia, what the military calls the Middle East, and a good portion of Southeast Asia.
And two things you say that spring from the conclusions in the gap seem to be a little bit at odds with one another. One, you tell us that we're going to have to get used to the idea of perpetual warfare within the gap, transnational and subnational warfare of asymmetric folks, guerrillas and terrorists. Mm-hmm. You also tell us if we can connect the gap and shrink the gap, we have an opportunity for an historic period of peace. So those seem to be two mutually exclusive premises or conclusions, and maybe you'll address that as we get into your second book.
Sure. Well, the basic idea there is with the second book, the first book was kind of a system-level diagnostic of the world as it is today. Parts of the world that are coming together peacefully, national economies integrating, two-thirds of humanity, that's what I call the functioning core, the Old West, plus most of the Old East, to include a China and a India and a Brazil, other rising
powers. The Old West being North America, Western Europe, and Japan.
Australia, New Zealand, those kinds of countries. So that's the functioning core, as I describe it, two-thirds of humanity peacefully coming together. Not a big role for the military, really, except in a latent sense, to prevent great power war, which I argue is fairly easy. So if you look at it in that way, you move away from the Cold War, there's not really much threat in terms of global nuclear Armageddon. If you actually add up interstate war, country A attacks country B, that's going the way of the dinosaur. So what we're describing inside the gap are those regions, about one-third of humanity, roughly 100 countries, is we're talking a lot of civil strife. Right. We're talking failed nations, failed governments that can't keep security coherent in a state, and therefore economic activity can't occur in a meaningful fashion. They don't attract foreign direct investment, which leads to real integration. Or you're talking about bad governments, too much government, authoritarian regimes. Terrorists tend to be attracted to both, either as sponsors or as parasites, in effect, to failed nations.
And, of course, in the gap is a great deal of human misery, starvation, epidemics,
right,
and just living conditions that are beneath the human dignity often.
Basically, what you find in the gap is, since the end of the Cold War, all the wars, all the civil wars, all the ethnic cleansing, all the genocide, all the mass rape as a tool of terror, all the UN peacekeeping missions, all six of the U.S. nation-building missions. So my argument is, the core to succeed and continue to become wealthy and prosperous now has to not only shrink that gap for reasons of economics, but they have to do so in order to really eliminate over time the operating domain and the sources of transnational terrorism.
Now, you point out a very interesting irony, and that is as you talk about the need to bifurcate the way we do military operations.
Yeah.
And you indicate that in your view, the more successful we are at having complete dominance as an American military
in war,
the more challenging and lengthy the peace process is.
Right.
Maybe you can talk about that irony of it.
And that's not just my assertion. I mean, that's something we can track
history. Iraq is a great example. We win the war in 21 days. We topple Saddam. We're still, sometimes treading water in terms of winning the peace.
Right. Through the Cold War, we always had the Soviets to size our forces. Soviets go away in 1989. We institute this revolution in military affairs. We're adjusting our military from its industrial era roots to its information era capabilities. Okay? That process, I would argue, is largely consummated. And our ability to wage war, quite frankly, has gotten faster, cheaper, easier. It requires smaller numbers of personnel. Okay? So Don Rumsfeld was right on Iraq, small numbers of troops. But the corollary to that is, smaller the war force, bigger the peace force, shorter the war, longer the peace, less expensive the war, more expensive the peace. So Eric Shinseki, also right. The problem is, the way the media presented it too often was the question of how many troops to win the war. The answer was, Rumsfeld was right on how many troops to win the war. Shinseki was also right on how many troops to secure the peace. Two different discussions. I argue, you got that Leviathan force. It's there. We can wage war anywhere we want. What we need is a capacity to do the nation building and the post-conflict reconstruction. If you track, and here's a good one for the C-SPAN, if you track supplementals, okay, we don't actually budget for war or peace in the Pentagon. We budget for future forces. When we actually use the force abroad, we have to go to Congress and ask for supplementals. There's your purse strings, okay? We've asked for a roughly quarter trillion dollars, $250 billion roughly, since the end of the Cold War. If you add it up, 80%, post-conflict stabilization reconstruction, only about one-fifth is the war. So that tells you something.
Well, you talk about the transition from the Cold War, where the major confrontation was between two superpowers that were part of the core, new mm-hmm. core in the case of Russia now, as the way you define it, and the old core would be the United States and our allies in Britain and elsewhere.
Right.
In a way, we were very fortunate in the Cold War. Powerful enemy. We had a very rational one.
Right.
For example, when we say, get out of Cuba or you may risk nuclear war. In the Kennedy administration, the Russians reacted and they withdrew their nukes. In Afghanistan, the opposite happened.
Right.
President Carter, as a candidate, said that if the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, we really wouldn't do anything, but maybe some economic boycotts. And to their ultimate peril, the Soviets took his invitation and entered Afghanistan. But we had a very rational enemy.
Right.
Mutual assured destruction was based on the premise that they knew if they shot us, we'd shoot them, and it would be mutual suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our strategic arms limitation agreements were mm-hmm. built around the premise that neither side could defend one another,
right.
so that neither side would attack the other. But don't you presume, I mean, among other things, and we'll get to later, you suggest we just allow Iran in return for some help in the Middle East to have nuclear capabilities. So you suggest, we'll get to this, that we ought to allow the Chinese to settle the Taiwan Strait issue on their terms. And, of course, then we have the terrorist problem throughout the gap.
Right.
Don't a lot of your assumptions rely on having rational enemies today, like the Soviets, when, in fact, we've got a lot of irrational enemies?
To segue off your first point, which is a really good one, because prior to the Second World War, we had two different departments. We had a Department of War, and we had a Department of everything else called the Navy at that point, which maintained our connectivity with the global economy, which until the Second World War was basically defined as freedom of the seas. Okay? We merged those two concepts in 1947. And what we do, in effect, and it becomes our long-term rationale for exactly what you were talking about, we merged the concept of national security and international security. To attack America is possibly to light up the entire planet. That was the underlying thesis, mutual assured destruction. What's scary about the Cold War era, in effect, is we've lost that connection. Osama bin Laden kills 1 million people tomorrow in Indianapolis. If you can't name who you're going to bomb the next day in terms of retaliation, then you can't give me somebody to deter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If you're going to do it in terms of where this guy's probably located, I mean, what exactly would bombing Pakistan get you in terms of retaliation? What deterrence? What connection? Nothing. And that's the scary part. What we're really trying to do in many ways, what I'm trying to do in this Pentagon's new map, Blueprint for Action, is trying to put out a national grand strategy for the United States that defines shrinking the gap as a international grand strategic goal for the United States. And on that basis, link it to a definition of U.S. national security. Okay? And it's a metaphor that it employs a lot of concepts from the world of information technology. Okay? You can only make your network as secure as every other network you're connected to. Okay? So I don't believe in the concept of the home game. I don't believe in many ways in the concept of homeland security. I think it's a nonsense concept in the sense that, again, our network, being so globalized as we are, can only be secure as the rest of the world's networks are. So it's not about fixing America post 9/11. It's about exporting our rule sets in many ways, which are fairly robust on security and other things, to the rest of the world, raising their standards, or in my vernacular, shrinking the gap, making globalization truly global, creating connectivity around the planet, which comes with rules, which comes with organizations that enforce rules, that gives you the global community that everybody wants to see and enforces norms. And on that basis, that's how we connect our definitions of national security with international security. I am assuming, with connectivity and with code that comes with connectivity, that we're going to be dealing largely with rational actors. To the extent that we meet people who resist that Borg-like embrace, that resistance is futile, you will be assimilated kind of feeling that a lot of people associate with globalization because it's so reformatting in terms of culture. It really does demand a lot from people. There will be people who resist that, okay, and they will resist it primarily, I think we'll find time and time again, because of what it does on a social basis, not economic, not political. We do the polls in the Middle East. What we find is they admire our politics. They wish they had our markets. What they find reprehensible are our social values. And it frankly comes down to the liberated role of women in many instances.
Right, and we're going to talk about that in the second segment. Well, I want to ask you about whether Americans will have the stomach for this, because in many respects you imply that we need to be the world's policeman. After all, your theory is that our entire security rests on what happens in the disconnected, you can say underdeveloped, you can say third world.
Right.
And
poorly integrated.
Poorly integrated. You'll remember that Jefferson said that we should be peaceful friends and trade partners with all, but have entangling alliances with none. You remember that President Adams, our second president, said that America does not go abroad seeking monsters to destroy. After 9/11, I had a private meeting with Secretary Colin Powell at the time, and mm-hmm. he said we had a great debate over, on one extreme, isolationists in our country versus the internationalists mm-hmm. over the first 200 years. His point was that we are all reluctant internationalists now, and I guess that's a point that you're trying to make. Do you think after Vietnam, where Americans wanted to pull back and retrench we wanted to draw up the bridge around our castle to some extent.
Right, right.
And Iraq, there's some similar feeling out there in the United States. Do you think that Americans will have the stomach for what you say is going to be, you point out that we're never going to be able to, quote, bring the boys home, that this is a continual battle in the disconnected world. Will Americans have the political stomach, or is that a question for people like me in Congress to answer?
Well, I think what we got to do is disaggregate the nature of the problem. And that's a big theme of the second book, Blueprint for Action, which, the first one, again, nation, international diagnostic. The second book, more nation-state prescriptive. These are things you need to build. These are organizations you need to create. These are rule sets you need to enunciate or find agreement upon with fellow allies. I think what we're lacking in the system, which will give us some sense as to when or when not to employ this incredible capacity for war making, which I call the Leviathan, is we need to be able to contextualize the use of that force within a larger rule set. John Kerry called it a global pest in the 2004 campaign. I agree with that notion to a certain extent. I'm not willing, though, to ask everybody on the planet for their permission. Okay, so not all 192 nations of the UN, because I don't believe everybody has the same incentives to push for the collective good called international security. I want to focus on roughly the top 20 economies, which is roughly 90% of the global GDP and roughly 70% of the global population.
The G20 would be a good...
Right. It's exactly the G20. So I'm looking for, in effect, a supermajority. Mm-hmm. And I think that's realistic. In that supermajority, what I'm looking to put together, which I argue in the book, is something we've actually already achieved. The question is, can we regularize it? Can we make it transparent? Can we make it seem like a non-zero-sum process? And on that basis, attract the coalition partners that, frankly, are going to do most of the heavy lifting for us.
Well, I have some questions about that very thing, because there seems to be some real challenges to get there. In the first place, I want to point out that Michael Barone of U.S. News and World Report says that the current Bush-Iraq strategy looks awful lot like what Thomas Barnett has called for in the Pentagon's new map and a blueprint for action with respect to the way you define a two-tier force. One would be the Leviathan that wins the war. The other would be the systems administration that wins the peace.
Right.
So this is very interesting. You just got back from talking to General Abizad. The Pentagon is listening, and they are focusing on a lot of your recommendations. But here's sort of the irony I find, and again, something that you're going to have to describe for us. Collective security has never been any security at all. Look at the League of Nations, United Nations. Neither one ever deterred an aggressor from attacking another. They were totally unsuccessful in preventing World War II or the Cold War or any of the other aggressions. You say that America can win the war without help from allies, but we cannot win the peace.
Right.
You also say that we should never go to war unless we are prepared to win the peace.
Right.
So, by process of logic, we should never go to war unless we've got enough allies to win the peace, and that's the prescription you just described. And yet, in Iraq, for example, we couldn't get most of the world to agree to help us to enter the war phase. So how do we ever tackle monsters in the gap or elsewhere if we can't get the world, after 14 resolutions in the United Nations,
right,
to agree that Saddam Hussein should be eliminated. We can't go to war unless we win the peace. We can't win the peace without allies, i.e. we can't go to war under your premises until we've got people agree to help us. And that didn't happen in Iraq.
Well, I think what happened in Iraq revealed sort of the spotty nature of a system that I would describe as an A to Z rule set for successfully processing politically bankrupt states. And I make the analogy to what we have in the IMF for processing economically bankrupt states. When a country, in effect, goes default on its bonds, like Russia did in 97 or Argentina did recently, they go in at A, they come out at Z, and there's a sense that it's a non-zero-sum process. Everybody wants Russia and Argentina to succeed. They want them to get back in the game, get back on the court, and get back in the business of trading and accepting foreign direct investment. We don't have a process for taking a bad state and kind of, you know, taking down its leader, replacing the government, and rehabilitating a politically bankrupt state as we do with an economically one. If we had such a system, and I believe it's there in embryonic form, what would it look like? I say it's a six-part system. You basically got the UN, which can indict them, okay? They can start the process, but they can't finish it. They can express the will of the international community. Downstream from that, what we need...
Well, but the UN has indicted Israel more than any other country on the planet, and the UN doesn't typically share our values. Do we
really... Well, I think the UN has indicted Israel. That's more a Cold War phenomenon. That has really tapered off since we no longer have a superpower rivalry. I think it is emerging quite effectively, and I think that's why they recognized Kofi Annan. I think that's why they recognized the IAEA with the two Nobels. They are good at defining transgression against international norms. They can't do much about it, but they can certainly define it, okay? And they can't muster the will to act on it because they're trapped with this rule set that is so inefficient because it was really designed to prevent a rerun of the Second World War. It says all states are equally sovereign. And my argument is, inside the core, yes. Inside the gap, no.
Thus, they need a world policeman.
In effect. They need some larger leviathan to take down bad people, but they also need some larger organization to decide when to use that leviathan and to rehabilitate those people, because the ultimate goal of taking down a bad government is to bring that populace into an international community. Otherwise, it's just drive-by regime change, and you're only making the environment safe for terrorists. So if you have the UN to indict, you need a functioning executive to act on that indictment. Again, I think that's the G20. Okay, they decide when to unleash the leviathan. Then that needs to be followed up by some sort of internationally recognized and internationally populated system administrator force. A certain role for the U.S., especially in the lead elements in terms of the sequencing, but largely a role for other major powers that aren't comfortable committing troops to combat because simply they don't have those capabilities in the way that we do, but do want to be part of the solution set. Fifth element, what Sebastian Mallaby of the Washington Post calls for, an international reconstruction fund modeled on the IMF that specializes in rehabbing states post-conflict. The biggest cause of civil war in the world today, civil war, and the inability to get out of the cycle. In the first 5 years after a civil war, you're about 40% likely to go back into civil war. So you got to break that cycle. What we've discovered as we've studied these post-conflict situations is flood them with peacekeepers, years 1 through 3, really flood them with aid about years 4 through 7. Because if you give them aid years 1, 2, 3, and you don't give them peacekeepers, what they do is they buy guns.
Right.
And that scares the rebels or the insurgents or the fragile peace, and you're back to war. And then the sixth element, which we already have, which we're not that comfortable with for a variety of reasons, the International Criminal Court. Okay? You indict them?
Well, I'll give you one reason. The International Criminal Court has entertained indictments of people like Secretary Kissinger and Wesley Clark,
right,
who, like you, is a Democrat. And the International Criminal Court makes a lot of people, me included, very uncomfortable.
It was designed, really, for the gap. It was designed for countries that don't have robust enough legal rule sets to police themselves. So they were trying to create an International Criminal Court that would be able to prosecute war criminals engaging in activity there. What they have not done in that treaty, which we sought to reconcile by cutting, in effect, bilateral exclusionary or immunity treaties with virtually every country inside the gap, they did not make clear that they weren't seeking to prosecute the peacekeepers and the military interventionary forces or the political masters of those forces.
Well, they ought to have their jurisdiction limited, and that would be a absolute requisite before a lot of us would see any legitimacy whatsoever. How does your premise in both the Pentagon's new map and the Blueprint for Action differ from, say, Professor Niles Ferguson, who is a Scotchman teaching in America today, who has written, among other things, the book Colossus? He says that whether we like it or not, and while Americans are very uncomfortable about it, we are an empire, not just a military empire with governors throughout the planet like the Roman Empire had or the British Empire may have had, but we're an empire because we've got a McDonald's on every street corner, because we've got technology throughout the world. Right. And how does your theory differ from Mr. Ferguson?
I think he draws too much from history, and I think he really perverts the term empire.
In my mind, some people would say you don't focus enough on history, and you're very optimistic in places because you haven't focused enough on the historical problems that people have had getting along with one another. I mean, war is sort of a perpetual part of history, and you say we could almost eliminate it.
Well, I say that where globalization has spread itself with connectivity, and where you apply mutual assured destruction in the presence of nuclear weapons since 1945, which basically make great power war not possible, then you really are talking about the situation where the only conflicts left are inside states or in terms of transnational actors who seek to do somebody harm. And that is, for all practical purposes, the end of war as we have historically defined it. So I'm a believer that connectivity creates peace. I'm not naive about it whatsoever. I think nukes plus America's Leviathan-like military power is what has created barriers to entry to the marketplace we used to call great power war.
Right.
So I think maintaining that hedge is enormous. About Ferguson, my basic argument would be empires are about the enforcement of not just minimal rule sets, what you cannot do, but they're the enforcement of maximal rule sets, what you must do. Okay. America has never sought to govern its people on that basis, and we don't seek to govern the world on that basis at all. Globalization comes with rules, not a ruler. Okay, what we have done, really quite extensively for the last 25 years, is we enforce the minimal rule sets for any country that seeks to maintain connectivity with the global economy. If you want to be connected to the global economy, certain bad things you cannot do. Don't commit genocide inside your borders. Do not seek weapons of mass destruction unless there's some logic that we can see with some country nearby where there's a standoff that makes sense to us, like in India or Pakistan. Don't support terrorists. Don't move counterfeit currency. Don't export drugs. And you know, what are the bad actors that we're most concerned with inside the gap? They're countries that tend to do all those things, because in their disconnectedness from the global economy, they seek to enforce their authoritarian rule over their own people, which means they have to keep them separate from the outside world. The only interactions they can have with that legitimate world are those that tend to be of a criminal or a transgression of security.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk to you about some fascinating suggestions, and we're going to ask the audience to stay with us because, among other things, you don't think it's a serious problem for Iran eventually to have nuclear weapons.
No.
You suggest that we may want to have settled the Taiwan Strait issues on terms that the Chinese government would be very supportive of in return for some things. And finally, you're going to tell us why we can tell everything we need to know about society by how they treat their women.
Yeah.
So with that, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Afterwards, with Thomas P.M. Barnett and Congressman Tom Feeney, will continue in a moment.
Book TV live coverage of the Texas Book Festival continues Sunday with Gary Wills, author of Henry Adams and the Making of America. Also, Jane Smiley on the writing of the novel, a panel on the Iraq War, and Peter Stoddard, author of 30 Days, an inside account of Tony Blair at War. The Texas Book Festival continues from Austin tomorrow at 12:30 p.m. Eastern.
Afterwards, with Thomas P.M. Barnett and Congressman Tom Feeney continues.
We are back with Mr. Thomas Barnett, the author of two fascinating new books that have stirred up a lot of geopolitical and visionary thinking in America, including places like the Pentagon and the White House. And they're called the Pentagon's New Map and A Blueprint for Action is the most recent book, much like the Harry Potter novel set. You'll want to read both of them, starting with the Pentagon's new map. Now, before we talk about Iran and China and the status of women in the globe, you say that the biggest mistake that the Bush administration has made is in setting up the Department of Homeland Security.
Right. And I tag Congress with that as well.
Well, absolutely. Of course, that was a response to the 9/11 attack.
And anthrax.
And anthrax. Well, yep, among other things. Legislative bodies do their worst work in response to anecdotal crises, is my experience.
I would argue that you're very correct in that assessment.
And you do say we need a new Department of Global Security. And this is part of your suggestion that we separate and bifurcate the military operations. On the one hand, you want an Air Force and a naval carrier-based technology-dominating military power that can go in a flexible basis and win a war on very short order.
The world's biggest gun.
Right. And on the other hand, you want a economic, political, and police-type force led by Americans with help from other nations.
Very fused with developmental expertise, very fused with infrastructure.
The World Bank, private organizations,
charities.
A very
comprehensive package.
Et cetera. And I thought it was important that we point out that you believe the biggest mistake that the Bush administration has made is in setting up that department. You call the Department for Global Security the department for everything else.
Right.
It's not killing bad regime leaders and defeating bad states. Everything else ought to be part of the Department of Global Security.
Right.
I wanted to ask you before we talk about Iran and China also about sort of a theoretical question. You are a political scientist by degree. President Bush talks a lot about democracy. I mean, the Bush doctrine seems to be that every peoples everywhere are ready for self-government. Natan Sharansky, in his book, The Case for Democracy, talks about the fact that democratic peoples don't tend to attack one another.
Very true.
Different view than yours, which is based on connectivity and than disconnectivity.
I can link those two for you.
Well, I'd like to hear that, but it seems interesting to me on a theoretical basis that the one sentence in your book that I will quarrel with, and you explain it, so I want you to explain this. You said that democracy is an end and not a means.
Right.
I happen to believe, as does Edmund Burke, for example, the opposite, democracy is a process, that freedom and liberty is the end. I mean, democracy included voting for people like Hitler. Democracy in the southern United States would have included lynching black Americans on the spot if they were accused rightfully or wrongfully without the due process. So
I think those statements actually prove my point better.
Well, and because as you read further past the sentence that I don't like, you talk about the culture that has to be changed in order to lay the groundwork for democracy.
Right.
That goes back to Edmund Burke's point.
Right. It's complex.
He, you know, the greatest conservative philosopher of the last 300 years, and he suggested that it took time to develop and prepare the prerequisites in a society for democracy.
Right.
So will you elaborate on that and tell us why democracy is a means or an end or both?
I think it's an end in the sense that I believe markets, good markets need good governments. Okay, that's a statement made by Martin Wolf, a senior economist at The Economist, who wrote a great book on globalization called Why Globalization Works. I'm enough of a historical determinist to say you get democracies where you get free markets, and you get good governments in places where the private sector is allowed to flourish and make demands upon a government in terms of services, in terms of protection, in terms of all sorts of things. That's what gets you an efficient and a pluralistic government. I mean, our government didn't have, in effect, direct elections for the president or the Senate. Theoretically, we don't have direct elections for the president still. We didn't have a vote for women. Much of our population wasn't considered a citizen for quite some time. It took us decades to move into the kind of maturity that we got. And my argument is what drove that maturity more than the political process of democracy was the economic process of building this incredible, what I argue to be the first multinational economic union in global history. In effect, the source code for globalization. Free goods and services moving across borders, single currency.
You're talking about different states.
Right.
And your point is that 13 colonies, now 50 states, independent in many ways, actually move towards a central currency and
right.
culture.
Right. That it's that transaction rate within those states and among those states that generated a good, strong federal government,
and you
which
believe,
frankly became strong after the Civil War.
And you believe that countries that become part of the core can be part of that same process of integration, like the 50 states are integrated.
And that economics will lead that process.
Right.
Okay. So I'm more interested in China joining the World Trade Organization and China increasing the broadband economic connectivity between their public and the outside world than I am with a single party still dominating. Because what I've seen historically when countries try to develop rapidly is that it's almost always done with single parties. Japan did it. South Korea did it. Mexico did it. Singapore still does it. You just take the moniker, the adjective communist off, and you've got the same basic model in China.
It takes a dictator to create a functioning economy and
right.
society, and then it takes grassroots
markets.
Control to protect markets.
Right, okay. right, right. Autocrats build nations, democracies run them.
Okay, and 1 minute on Iran. You say that more than any other country on the globe, the future of Iran will determine the future of peace and security.
It's the linchpin country in the Middle East.
And why should they have nuclear weapons?
The reasons why Nixon chose them to be our regional security pillar back in the Nixon Doctrine, way back with the Shah, a lot of those reasons still hold. It is the most dominant military power there, especially after Saddam's military was decimated and taken off the map. It is Persian as opposed to Arab. It is the de facto leader of the Shiite world, which is a very vocal and very tumultuous minority within Islam. It can veto peace in Beirut, in Baghdad, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, through its support for terrorist networks, Hamas, and Hezbollah. I think it's impossible to imagine a stable Middle East 10 years from now where we haven't co-opted Iran. And I think our moment for co-opting Iran right now is not dissimilar to the way we co-opted the Soviet Union in the early 1970s. Bankrupt ideology, a failed revolution, population largely dissociated from the political process, young, educated, ambitious. The people love us. It's the government that doesn't like us. I think that's a tired authoritarian regime that we can kill with an opening up process like we do with the Soviet Union. I mean, we perverted that system from within with detente, and we decimated it 16 years later without firing a shot. I think we can marginalize the mullahs inside Iran, and in effect turn them into the equivalent of late-night televangelists there by removing their role from the political process, simply by creating broadband economic opportunity. I think the holdup right now is that we tend to isolate them on the basis of WMD, and we make that the be-all and end-all. And to me, that's like, you know, you don't arrest a criminal because he uses a gun. You arrest the criminal because he committed a crime, not because of the mechanism, but because of cause and effect.
Well, to the extent that Iran wants to wipe out Israel, or at least the mullahs and the leadership of Iran, and to the extent that that could be the catalyst for
that's
the
been
next
a rhetorical
world war.
Statement. That's been a rhetorical statement.
Well, it's more than rhetorical. How would the Israelis feel if we acceded to the demands of Iran to have nuclear capability?
Well, if the Israelis were smart, what they'd recognize is that we finally have some sort of bilateral balance in terms of nuclear weapons in the region. One of the big drawbacks for peace in the Middle East has been that the Arab world and the Muslim world in general has said Israel's got the bomb and they have a superpower with a bomb behind them. We used to have the Soviets. They went away. Nobody here has the bomb that can really use it or apply some sort of balancing leverage against Israel. And on that basis, what's happened since the Soviet Union went away? The United States has come in and waged war with impunity in our region. So getting, you know, ask yourself why Iran wants the bomb. And ask yourself if you can give Iran what it wants in such a way that you co-opt them as a security partner. Because my argument is if you continue to isolate them, what you're going to end up with is an India and a China siding with Iran for oil and natural gas reasons. That simply we can't satisfy their requirements. They need that access to oil and natural gas. You run the risk of creating a Yalta-like divide in the Middle East where the East gets the Shiites, we end up with the Sunnis, and we bifurcate this globalization process. And I don't want to see that happen because I think we're just going to waste a lot of money, waste a lot of lives, and waste a lot of opportunity.
Well, I think it's a great point. I want to get off the Iran-Israel nuclear issue, but it's critical, and you recognize you've got a lot of convincing to do, both in the United States and elsewhere around the world. A country of 6 to 7 million people surrounded by Arab nations. And one rhetorical question, I guess, just to think about is why would Iran need nuclear capabilities if we can stabilize the peace between Israel and its neighbors and if Iraq becomes a democracy?
They don't need it.
Right.
What they need is to be recognized as the security pillar of note in the Persian Gulf. And you know what? They are. And the question is, how do we co-opt them in that process and use them to our advantage to create peace and stability?
I want to talk about China because you've got some fascinating theories about the opportunity to buy China's cooperation and friendship is cheaper now than it's ever going to be.
And
you believe that the price either now or later is going to be Taiwan and that that's sort of a fait accompli. They're never going to get off their total focus on Taiwan. So your suggestion is that we overturn policy really since at least the Nixon administration that
codified 1979.
Yep, America stand behind the ability of Taiwan to defend itself. And of course there are different languages very important in the
right.
Taiwan Straits, as you know. Tell Americans why you believe we ought to refocus our strategy on Taiwan, and then we'll get into what you believe the future of an Asian regional organization cooperative between the United States
right.
and China and others. But tell us why we ought to, in your view, change our historic relationship with Formosa or now.
Well, the starting concept is you look ahead 20 or 30 years, it's obvious that China's going to be the world's second largest economy. Okay. So you put together an alliance between the United States and China, and I argue you cannot break globalization. I mean, you really secure a global economy for the long term if these two countries do not become enemies. In many ways, it is our choice, like it was Britain's choice, how to view a rising China today, how Britain chose to interpret a rising America at the beginning of the 20th century. Very similar emergence point for China today, 100 years later, okay? And my argument is the alliance that is inevitable between the United States and China is going to be as important for the 21st century as the one between the Brits and the Americans was for the 20th century. So how do we get there? If we're going to be grand strategists, we're going to think about a future worth creating, how do we get there, okay? What we have is this tailbone from the Cold War, our blank check promise to defend Taiwan at all costs, okay? Now, that was written for another era when it was communists versus the West, and that was a way of demonstrating to China
the domino theory.
Right, right. And when an exact opposite process is occurring now, Southeast Asia is becoming more capitalistic in response to China's rapid embrace of capitalism.
You say they're the greyhound of capitalism in Asia.
The running dogs of capitalism, right. as they used to call it. So how do we get China to deep security alliance? Because what scares me now is that our economic connectivity with China is vastly outweighs our political and military connectivity to them. And the danger would be misperceptions leading to war. The United States and China goes to war. I don't think there's a faster way to turn both of us into second-tier powers in the 21st century than that kind of conflict. And the danger is the flashpoint of Taiwan. Now, the danger is that we have given, with this blank check, in effect, Taipei the opportunity to declare war between the world's two most important powers. And I don't like giving Taiwan that much control over our future security. So what I say is make clear to Taiwan that, in effect, the defense guarantee is quite conditional. It is not an open check. Okay? And if they want to start a war between themselves and China, they cannot account in any certain sense that we're going to bail them out. That if they transgress what China has made clear as the five no's, okay, five things you cannot do, and China's been very specific about this. In effect, they've said, as long as you don't change the status quo and make it seem like it's impossible that someday we could integrate, and you know they're going to integrate over time in a larger Asian Union, just like France and Germany and a whole bunch of other countries in Europe have come together in a larger EU. That kind of process is inevitable. So China says, as long as you don't transgress the notion that someday we could become a unified whole, we're happy with the status quo. We seek no opportunity to invade or conquer you. That's all they've asked for, and I want to make apparent in our relationship with China that we're not giving a blank check to Taipei, and we have absolutely no interest in seeing this conflict erupt.
Well, you seem to be the mirror opposite of Marx. I know you taught Marxism because you happen to be, it seems like, an historic and economic determinist for capitalism and free markets.
Absolutely.
And that's very, very
Marx
interesting.
Marx was too. He just didn't go all the way.
Well, and he was an optimist for his theory, as you are for years.
Yes.
But using your analogy of the British attitude towards the colonies and mistakes they made towards the United States that led up to the war for independence, at the time it took 3 or 4 weeks to send a ship from the United States to Britain. We certainly weren't any threat to do any damage to them. What America wanted was liberation from taxes and what we thought was oppressive government, or at least some of the colonists did. But the Chinese, who have had a very powerful army that we don't have a problem with, because what armies tend to do, as you've pointed out, on the mainland in Asia, is they tend to protect things and defend things. And that's how Mao defeated Chiang Kai-shek and united all the many different provinces. And you point out that today China is really a group of disparate provincial communities. That
a huge civilization
that only barely have relationships with the national or the federal government.
Right.
But China is now developing, and the very people in the Pentagon that are so worried about your theories, China is now developing a world-class naval capability, a submarine nuclear capability.
But not a blue water one. Let's make that distinction.
Okay.
And what we mean when we say blue water is one that can travel the planet and project power.
Right.
They are building, in effect, a navy that threatens our ability to threaten their ability to threaten Taiwan. That is a very specific force. Okay. And that just tells me that the Taiwan issue and its capacity to create war through misperception is very, very dangerous.
Well, last week, Secretary Rumsfeld gave a speech to some Chinese officials where he talked about the danger of the Chinese not being transparent in terms of what their military intentions and capability are. So,
and they have similar charges for us in terms of this global war on terrorism.
Well, I understand, but we haven't threatened any of the sovereignty of the Chinese government at all, and they're not threatening ours at this
point. But look at it from their perspective. They're becoming hugely dependent on Middle Eastern oil. Two-thirds of the oil that comes through the Persian Gulf today goes to Asia. Mm-hmm. They're going to be overwhelmingly dependent on that region's stability in coming decades in a way that America, frankly, isn't. We get very little of our oil, frankly, from the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. It represents, in the single digits, our total energy requirements. We could get along without the Middle East quite nicely. It would be an adjustment. But Asia depends on that stability. If you're China and you're facing that kind of dependency and the other big power in the system, the United States, just toppled a government in the country that owns the world's second largest energy supplies and has declared an ambition to transform the region, would you be a little nervous about that other great power? So looking at it from their perspective, I mean, even the modest reaches they've made in terms of developing a capacity to project power in the direction of Taiwan, really not much further, to me makes a lot more sense than I think we allow.
Well, and but your theories on China, you'll acknowledge, have a lot of optimism based on the connectivity. You point out accurately, for example, that GM expects to make more money this year selling automobiles in Asia than in all of North America.
Yeah.
Pretty exciting stuff.
I believe in greed and human nature.
Well, I guess the question is, as much as we're all anxious to have an interconnected relationship on commerce grounds, going back to
sure.
Washington and Jefferson, who were
sure.
very much isolationist on some of the military aspects,
right.
I guess the question is, how do we protect ourselves in case the optimism of Thomas Barnett is wrong about the long-term intentions of mainland China?
We need to lock them in now in strategic alliance. We need to create the military connectivity that's commensurate with the economic connectivity. My fear, frankly, right now, is that I would argue our political leadership, by and large, our military leadership, by and large, have no idea how intertwined our economic destinies are today. Not theoretically, not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now. China and the United States, our economic destinies are vastly interconnected. I mean, they determine a lot the price of money in this country, the price of credit cards, the interest rates on our mortgages, the price of darn near everything in a Walmart. The connectivity is a lot more than we realize, and I would argue we need to normalize that relationship a little bit and get us more militarily connected so that capacity for us to turn on one another and destroy a globalization process that has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in the last 20 years, specifically in that part of the world, is a very big good that I'm willing to sacrifice some things to achieve. So I would put Taiwan on the table in terms of a negotiation. More to the point, I would put North Korea on the table.
I wanted to get to North Korea.
And say, if we are putting missile defense in that part of the world that makes China nervous, if we are investing that kind of money and we're doing all these things basically on this last possibility of a rogue nation with missiles that can reach the United States, then the answer is, let's not go defensive, let's go offensive. Kim Jong-il is responsible for the death of at least, we believe, 2 million people in his own country in a preventable famine in the late 1990s. He exports counterfeit U.S. bills throughout Asia. Huge problem for China. He exports drugs in a big way. This is a pure kleptocratic regime with absolutely no moral authority, treats its people very abusively. 40% of the children in that country malnourished. The average child in North Korea, several inches shorter, you know, tens of pounds lighter than the counterpart in South Korea. This is my equivalent of the horrible New York City case where you discover that the parents have been keeping the child in the closet for 5 or 6 years. Okay, what are the rights of that parent in that moment? The answer is they have no rights. They are so abusive. They have so failed in their role as parents. This is what the Kim Jong-il regime represents in North Korea. I would argue alliances come from victories. And what we have in the four countries that have come together, in addition to South Korea, in the so-called six-party talks that include North Korea, are the makings of an East Asia NATO.
Right.
And I would take down Kim as quickly as possible, dangling, in effect, in China's face a real incentive, which is we will make an East Asia NATO over this evil dictator's grave. We will recognize in that process that you are the dominant security player in the region. On that process, we want you to make sure that as the Asian Union comes about economically, and that process is taking off rapidly with an ASEAN Association for Southeast Asian Nations bringing in a China, negotiating.
And you say Japan. Eventually nations in that community are going to have no choice if forced to choose between China and the U.S., including our traditional allies like Singapore and Australia. They'll be forced to choose friendship with China.
In the same way that Canada is forced to choose friendship with the United States or Mexico.
Right.
Okay. And I don't think that's being idealistic. I think that's being highly realistic for right. economic reasons. And I can't expect Australia or even Canada, when we get in this tussle over the lumber tariffs, I can't expect them to forego the economic opportunities provided by a China ad infinitum over our inability to move off certain definitions of China from the past. I honestly believe, and I think it's a harder explanation for anybody over a certain age range because we were so imprinted, frankly, by the Cold War, I think we're moving from a paradigm in which we have long assumed that if you're like us politically, then you're our friends, to a new paradigm, which says in the age of globalization, if you're like us economically, that's going to be the truer basis of our friendship.
Mm-hmm. I want to move to sort of summarize some of the things that you think need to be done for the gap. And you list three things that are most important in order to bring the gap up to the 21st century, to
right.
disconnect or to connect them to the rest
right.
of the world and to
the global economy.
As you say, an historic period of peace for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Two are fairly obvious. You call for good government.
Better government.
You call for access to capital.
Right.
One that I think is very interesting, and you say again that you can tell everything you need to know about a state by how it treats its women, I think is the quote from the Blueprint for Action. And so empowering women. Are you the Susan B. Anthony for the globe these days?
Well, one of my heroes yet discovered is the feminist neocon who makes a central proposition for U.S. foreign policy the empowerment of women abroad. Because, frankly, you've never seen an economy develop in a broadband fashion until you've seen the women join that economy and add that power to the labor pool. Frankly, we really took off and globalized when we opened up our economy to women as a result of the tumultuous experience of the Second World War. Okay, you talk about the Asian miracles of the 80s and 90s. You're talking about countries that added women to their labor pool in a big, big way. If you basically take offline or make off limits half your population you cannot develop economically. If we expect countries to become pluralistic over time, we got to expect them to marketize and be successful at marketizing their economies and connecting themselves to the global economy. And that can't happen unless women are freed up. It's a very microcosmic definition of the journey from the gap to the core. It has to be done by freeing up women from their traditional roles as being primarily birthing machines to create lots of workers for farm labor.
In the agricultural.
In the agricultural. Right. You know, go back and look at the American Industrial Revolution in New England. Who populated all those factories in New England? They were women just off the farm. Who is populating all the activity to a great degree in China? The most valued labor category is a 19-year-old female just off the farm, willing to work for hardly anything in difficult conditions. That's what starts the industrialization process. So I argue you got to stop in a big way the trade, the agricultural subsidies that the United States has for its domestic agriculture. Allow the gap to get off sustenance agriculture on that basis. Allow women to be freed up from that kind of role in society. They need to be able to move to the city on that basis. You need to have good governance, which allows them, in terms of contract law and property law, to find real employment and real economic activity that's recognized by law and allows them to accumulate wealth. That kind of movement from the rural areas to the cities, accompanied by just enough law, is what brings in foreign direct investment and exploits cheap labor. Just like the Europeans exploited cheap labor in the United States across the 1800s and helped us dramatically build this country with their foreign capital. Nobody develops their economies without access to foreign capital.
Bottom line, empower women, create peace and prosperity.
The quickest way to develop a country, the simplest rule is educate young girls.
Mm-hmm. We only have a very brief time left. One of the many sub-premises of your book, which is, a fascinating book, the Blueprint for Action, is that the evangelical Christians may be the best opportunity to turn these third world gap countries into a connected, friendly, peace-loving community. You point out that there are more people attending Christian services on Sundays in China than in all of Western Europe put together. Is this the peaceful version of the Crusades that's going to bring world peace?
Well, you know, I really stress not making Islam the enemy, okay? And what I argue is there are parts of every religion that are fundamentalist, meaning they believe to be a true believer is to separate oneself from the rest of society. In the United States, we have the Amish, for example. Okay, they do this peacefully. What we see in the global Salafi jihadist movement are fundamentalists who seek separation through violent means. Okay, I think we have to distinguish between fundamentalists and evangelicals of all religions who basically seek connectivity through the spread of their faith. My argument is it's become a huge connective force. It's a very positive thing, and we need to seek to promote it as much as possible. Not surprisingly, evangelicals in this country are some of the biggest internationalists right now, most concerned about the environment, most concerned about human rights, most concerned about economic justice.
And Israel, and they're probably not in favor of nukes for Iran just yet, but it's been a fascinating discussion with Mr. Thomas Barnett, a thinker that has really gotten the attention of the White House, the Pentagon, futurists, and geopolitical strategists all around. I hope you've enjoyed this in the way I have. So thank you very much, Mr. Barnett. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.